nuclear, chemical, or biological weapons, and that it is conceivable that there was an intent at some point to reconstitute, but there were no nuclear weapons or chemical or biological, according to this report by a highly respected American investigator.
Yeah, but we suspected that because of earlier reports, whether it's from the whole range, David Kaye or whoever else it might have been. The Republicans, in the presence of Richard Perle here last night, Richard Perle being one, they found encouragement from the Duffel Report, too, said he was a good and respected man, and the fact that he had the intention to go ahead when the sanctions were lifted said all they needed to know about Saddam Hussein.
Well, I think that it's really going way beyond logic there. First of all, there were methods of finding out exactly what Saddam Hussein was doing and time to do an international approach to this. I mean, this was the whole point of the United Nations resolution, which allowed, in fact, I think President Bush actually won a victory in getting the inspectors back in. They'd been kicked out in 1998, and he should have let the inspectors do the job so that, in fact, we would know where we are, and it would not be after 1,066 Americans had died and after there'd been so many casualties. As I think it's impossible. What we are getting into here, Charlie, is somebody simply saying...
Shut the hell up, Albright. This nonsense about there were no nuclear or weapons of mass destructions according to this report. Look, don't play humanitarianism. You're not a humanitarianist. Don't play it now. This is ridiculous. When 500,000 people kicked the bucket in Iraq, mainly kids, and it was put to you, is it worth it? This is why you were under Crime Bill Clinton's administration. What did you say about it? You said, well, we consider the price worth it, that being the sanctions. And you sanctioned it all the way up to 1 million Iraqi kids primarily dying under your genocidal imperialist program. Then you have the nerve to break out with us. There were methods to find what Hussein was doing. Well, why did you keep raising the alarm bells? Because all you basically did was hand the baton off to Boy George so he can take it to his final solution. But we got another solution. Defeat of the imperialists. You know what time it is. Slave time. Shannon. You're listening to 104.1. 101.1/Freak Radio, Santa Cruz. 106.7, Illinois. LUVER.com. The world in radioforall.net. The universe, slave revolt time. Tonight we're going to start off with a commentary dealing with how things are on Sam's plantation and the concept of his death penalty game, legal and illegal. And then we're going to wrap it up with an analysis on the big anchors, Brokaw, Jennings, Ravis. So we got all that and a hell of a lot more on 104.1, Slave Revolt.
Living in the Philadelphia ghettos of Latinos and African Americans, after pursuing a direct appeal 6 years later on February 17th of 2000, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court awarded me a new trial on the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel. When we began the retrial, new counsel discovered that there was an eyewitness to the shooting who originally told the police during one of the proceedings in the first trial that I was not the person who he seen shoot his friend and brother of the sister who he was dating at the time of the murder. After hearing this new evidence, the jury believed them and decided to find me not guilty on all charges. What's so outrageous about it is that the prosecutor knew the identity of this eyewitness. The police knew of the identity of this eyewitness. They both spoke to this eyewitness previously, prior to the first trial. And yet they were willing to oppose a new trial and continue to conceal the identity of this eyewitness who apparently exonerated me. I fit the profile to death. I was convicted and sentenced to death.
White justice, black misery. The legal and illegal lynching of a people. The past and current realities of the U.S. government's state-sponsored legal executions and lynchings by racist white mobs of black people is an American tradition. And what we find in this tradition is a tradition of terror. What we also find are strong similarities in state-sponsored murders and racist mob murders. For example, often the truth doesn't matter. Often true justice of one's rights doesn't matter. Just the bloodlust of a violent racist nation that stands firm in the air of all of its hypocrisy. New York Times, June 11th, an innocent man lynched. A mob willfully and knowingly hanged and burned an innocent man, as well as another who was probably innocent near Mississippi City. Between midnight and 1 o'clock this morning, the lynching was the result of the impatience on the part of the people of Biloxi, a nearby town, over the failure of officers of the law to produce the man who a week ago murdered Christina Winterstein, a schoolgirl who was returning to her home near Biloxi after attending the commencement exercises of her school. The crime was an unusually atrocious one, even for outrages of this nature. And naturally, suspicion pointed to some unknown Negro as the perpetrator. Many arrests were made, and two of the suspects, Askew and Russ, were placed in the Mississippi City Jail for safekeeping. The proof against neither was more than remotely circumstantial. In the case of Askew, the district attorney made an examination and practically declared the man innocent. The next night, Askew was taken from the jail by a mob and tortured with fire to extort a confession. After the terrible ordeal, the mob virtually declared the man guiltless as they returned him to jail. Yesterday, the district attorney at a public meeting at Bilaspi obtained a pledge from the citizens not to molest the prisoner if they were returned for examination. It is stated on good authority that he thought the men could prove their innocence, and the citizens were aware of his views. Some refused to pledge themselves, and yesterday afternoon it was openly asserted that it was out of the question to think of postponing the matter any longer, as the crime merited a lynching. Last night, a crowd went to the jail, secured Askew and Russ, hanged them, fired into their bodies, and then built a fire under them. That was then. This is now. 1981 through 1995. Now to year 2004. The attempted lynching of Mumia Abu-Jamal. When Jamal's former lawyers Jackson hit the stand a while back during Jamal's appeals process in 1995, Jackson testified that he didn't want to be Jamal's lawyer during the original trial because he was ill-prepared and ill-financed, financed less than $4,000 during the original trial. He had himself removed, but the judge, Judge Sable, the state's head henchman, ordered Jackson back. Jamal's former lawyer related how the coroner's department, the police, and the prosecution withheld evidence in which Jackson said showed that the bullet that killed the cop that Mumia was convicted of killing was a .44 caliber out of a .44 gun. Mumia's gun that he carried with him while he drove his taxi at night was a .38. Jackson then stated that Sable then removed the black juror and allowed a white juror to sit in who admitted that he was antagonistic against Jamal. At that point, during the appeals testimony, Judge Sable, who was also residing over the appeals hearing, stopped Jackson in mid-testimony stating that he had to go out and get a sandwich. In other words, I'm sick of hearing the facts of the probable innocence of Jamal. Let's just lynch this nigga. If Sable and the FOP, Fraternal Order of the Police, had it their way, Mumia's case would have probably worked out like this. New York Record Hell, July 24th, 1900. Lynched before trial. Elijah Clark, a Negro 20 years old, was lynched at 2 o'clock this afternoon by an immense mob of citizens of Huntsville and the surrounding county. Clark was about to be removed from the Madison County Jail to the courthouse for a preliminary hearing when the mob compelled the officers to give him up, took him to the scene of his crime, hanged him, and riddled the body with bullets. That was then. This is now. In 1995, it appears that many people involved in who claimed that they were listening to the OJ criminal trial, including some of the victim's family members, would have preferred the Elijah Clark way, lynched before trial. Then, of course, there's the classic, find a Negro. Any Negro? Lynch a Negro! Chicago Record Hill, July 15, 1903. Rape victim witnesses lynching of attacker. Ed Kloss, a Negro, was lynched here, near here tonight, while his victim, Miss Susie Johnson, was looking on. Kloss was captured after being chased through seven counties by 50 farmers. Kloss attacked Miss Johnson last Thursday night as she was returning from a small school where she teaches class. The Negro kept her prisoner for several hours, and she was found next morning by a searching party. A posse was organized and a Negro was trailed from here almost to Savannahan before he was overtaken. He was brought here tonight by his captors and taken to the home of Miss Johnson. The young woman identified him, and when asked what she wanted done with him, she said, quote, he ought to be killed, unquote. The Negro was then tied to a tree, and the members of the mob fired at him until he was literally cut into pieces. Chicago Record held July 27, 1903. Wrong man lynched as racist, as rapist. Several days ago, a Negro supposed to be Ed Claus was lynched near Eastman, Georgia for assaulting Miss Susie Johnson, a young school teacher. The Negro protested he was not Claus and asked for time to prove his statement. But the mob was merciless. It now transpires that the Negro was not Claus and had never seen Miss Johnson. Claus, who assaulted the girl, has been located near Dorrance, Georgia. People passing through here tonight to secure him said that Claus would be taken from the offices and lynched. New York Age, April 30th, 1914, was powerless to aid sister who was raped and lynched. The brother of a young colored girl who was lynched by a mob of white ruffians near Wagner, Oklahoma, a few weeks ago, passed through this town on his way to Mexico. He gave a pathetic account of the lynching to colored citizens here. The young man's sister was but 17 years old and of respectable parents. Two half-drunken white men walked into their home during the absence of the mother and found the girl dressing, locked themselves into her room, and criminally assaulted her. Her screams for help were heard by her brother, who, kicking down the door, went to rescue her. In defending his sister, he shot one of the brutes. The other escaped. Later in the evening, the local authorities, failing to find the brother, arrested the sister. Find a Negro, any Negro, lynch a Negro, who was taken from jail by a mob at 4 o'clock in the morning and lynched. From his hiding place, the brother, who was 21 years old, could hear his sister's cry for help, but was powerless to aid her. That was then. This is now. In 1980, a 16-year-old white girl named Cheryl D. Ferguson was raped and murdered. The suspicion of the murderer turned to the school's 5 janitors. One of the school's janitors later testified that the cops looked at Clarence Bradley, the only black janitor, and said, quote, since you're the nigger, you're elected, unquote. Bradley was later convicted and sentenced to death by an all-white jury. It was found later that the prosecution intentionally suppressed evidence of Bradley's innocence and had their witnesses perjure themselves. After a tremendous battle, all charges were dropped and Bradley was set free after spending 10 years in jail in this travesty of justice. One's innocence doesn't always matter. Often, just the color of one's skin. Even the presiding judge in Bradley's appeals case admitted as much. Quote, the court unequivocally concludes that the color of Clarence Bradley's skin was a substantial factor that pervaded all aspects in the state's capital prosecution of him. Unquote. In other words, white justice, black misery. But not all of the convicted innocent get off so lucky. Take the case of Lionel Herrera. America's white light of justice shines horribly clear. The nephew of the true murderer came forward stating that he witnessed his uncle kill this person. His uncle then turned to him and threatened to kill him if he ever said anything about it. The nephew, who was not even in his teens at the time, complied with his uncle's threat. But after many years had passed, the nephew, now a young adult, stepped forward with the truth. Herrera's attorneys presented with this and other strong new evidence revealing Herrera's probable innocence, asked for the case to be reopened to prevent the ultimate miscarriage of justice, the execution of an innocent person. The Department of Justice countered, stating that since Herrera had a fair trial, quote-unquote, the first time, and was validly sentenced, the new evidence supporting Herrera's claim of innocence was irrelevant. The Supreme Court agreed and rejected Herrera's appeals to reopen the case. Herrera, a most probable innocent man, was executed. Once again, white justice, black, hold on a sec. In this case, brown misery, which should be a good lesson for other people of color in this society, some of whom may think that they can slide by. Sam nearly exterminated all of the red from this hemisphere. Dropped the bomb on the yellows, and is 187ing brown from their own land. And well, white justice, black misery. We know what he's doing to black. The Supreme Court has ruled that condemned prisoners who have exhausted their appeals have no constitutional rights on having their cases being heard by the federal courts, even when evidence supports their innocence. What the courts are saying, in effect, is that if the states follow its laws and procedures, even if these laws and procedures are racist, sexist, and biased against the poor, then that's a fair trial, and you can be executed on that basis, guilty or not. White justice, black misery. Even if one's mental facilities are not quite there, it doesn't matter to a lawless, brutal government and its lawless, racist mob of holy terror. Montgomery Advertiser, August 25th, 1913. Negro half-wit is lynched, threatened to lynch whites. Deputy Sheriff David Kennebrook today reported the lynching of Wilson Gardner, a young Negro half-wit who was found Sunday hanging by a belt. Gardner had gone around to the homes of white miners near Kilgore carrying a rope and threatening to hang them. This disturbed the miners, who beat the half-wit to death before hoisting his corpse to a railroad trestle. That was then. This is now. In 1992, Bill Clinton signed the papers to have lobotomized half-wit Ricky Ray Rector put to death. Rector was in such a lost and mental state, poor mental state, that when they came to take him to his execution table, he asked them to save his pecan pie because he liked to eat it before he went to bed at night. And as they were strapping him down to destroy him, he commented on how he was going to vote for the then presidential candidate Bill Clinton. Clinton himself flew back to Arkansas to witness this execution. One must ask, what has truly changed? Certainly not white justice, black misery, for it is in our hands to change this madness. For those in power are not looking for true justice, just justice American style. A while back, executor former President Bill Clinton passed his own crime bill part 1 and 2 and the Effective Penalty and Anti-Terrorism Act, which really means ain't I the terrorist. And yes, Bill, you are. For in those bills, it reduces the number of appeals one is allowed after they are convicted. But in a staff report issued on October 21st, 1993, by the Subcommittee on Civil and Constitutional Rights called Innocence and the Death Penalty, it documented 48 persons who have been released from prison since 1973 after strong evidence and agitation for their release was won. Now that release of innocence is over 100. Many of these innocent inmates would have probably been destroyed if Clinton's bill of crime had been passed while they were in prison fighting for their appeals. That's the crime, Bill, that the death penalty is not designed for justice, but rather as a terror weapon unleashed out on the masses. The crime Bill and his supporters of death ignore is that the fact that large numbers of innocent known persons have been executed over the last few decades. But that's just it. The legal and illegal lynchings have never been about true justice, but about the violent terror of control used to suppress its desired targets. That, in America's capitalist system, translates to, amongst all other things, to white justice, black misery. This has been Tracy James with a commentary, White Justice, Black Misery, the Legal and Illegal Lynching of a People. Out.
That the media tells you the truth. The media, the media, the media, the media. How many of you really believe that the media tells you the truth?
They lie.
About to step into a Ventures in Corporate Media Land segment. And what we're going to deal to on Ventures tonight is basically the three stooges of the corporate established respectability media milieu. That is none other than Dan Rathers, Peter Jennings, and Tom Brokaw. Recently, they were in New York at the New Yorker Festival in Manhattan, and Ken Orletta, who's a media critic for New Yorker magazine, was the moderator, and he discussed various issues about what's going on in the world of corporate media land. And we're going to dissect it a little bit slave style and take it from there. So first, let's go into the anchor, who asked rather about the forged document fallout, you know, with Boy George and the National Guard and all of that. So let's see how Rather and Company handle it, and then we'll take it from there. Check it out.
Recently, CBS made a view, as one may have heard what LaGuardia said. If I were a young journalism student, and I came to you, Mr. Rather, and I said, and the same question been applied to the other two anchors, looking back with the benefit of hindsight, what was the biggest mistake that CBS made in contemporary?
Well, I appreciate your question, and I've tried to address that at least in part easily, but we have an independent review underway now, and I've been asked by the president of the news division while that's underway not to say anything more, and so that's going to be my answer for the moment.
I think to some extent we'll all say that. I mean, I think everybody in this room probably is interested in the media, and all of us interested in journalism all had our newsroom discussions about this, or discussions at home. I'd just like to add one thing about it, because we have no idea what the independent investigation is going to produce. But the one thing I feel quite strongly about, and I said this to Dan, I said it to everybody else, I don't think you ever judge a man by only one event in his career. So. Something about it as well. All the news divisions and most of the major newspapers in America have gone through these kinds of episodes. They are extremely painful. And I know how Dan feels about what he's going through, and the rest of us, I think, owe it to CBS News. They'll let that investigation play out so that we can find what the investigators determine and then react at the appropriate time to how CBS deals with that. But in the meantime, what I think is highly inappropriate is what's going on across the internet, a kind of political jihad against Dan Rather and CBS News that is quite outrageous. And I'm also struck by the fact that there's been very little attention given by those people who are initiating a lot of these attacks, what's happened to the investigation into who leaked it to Bob Novak, the use of what turned out to be a forged document to make a claim about uranium in Niger. I just say that I think this is probably incomplete in discussion, at least from my point of view, if we don't acknowledge, and I'm sure Dan does too, that this the blogging universe out there, in many respects, got this going. And I can't respond to CBS as to how they would have responded if not this had not appeared in the bloggers' universe, this questioning of the document. But that is a fact of our lives now, which in some respects is both healthy and certainly challenging. And I don't know that we thought in early parts of our career we were going to spend as much time reading, in many cases, anonymous people on the internet to find out what we were doing every day. but I think it has come to that extent. So I don't think you can just say that this is a universal, let's get CBS.
Now, what's kind of scandalous about some of the stuff that was said was the whole pretext of all of this. You know, when Rathers and them go on about the whole fallout over the forged documents, it gives the impression, that they're somehow in some kind of opposition wing, as you know, the corporate media, to the ruling class. But instead of going into and examining, which of course they're not going to, all of the stuff that they do and have done to bend over backwards for the administration and allow the administration basically to make up their own intel type organization and then go forward with their next game plan, which was the imperial attack on Iraq. This goes basically without a pause. You have a situation where all those major networks have the repetitive comments that Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice were saying before the 9/11 hits, how Saddam was contained, how he wasn't a threat to anyone, including his neighbors, how the sanctions and so on and so forth were effective against them. Then after 9/11, they just raise up a new flag and say it's time to go to battle, that that Saddam is a major threat to the world security and all of this, you know, aluminum tubes and uranium nitrous stories started popping up. All rather, and all of them had to do was just play a lot of the excerpts that they had conversations of Rice and them and Powell back in the day. They didn't do any of that. Or they could have continuously ran out Scott Ritter, who is actually a credible inspector at the time, and has written his own book concerning how Boy George and his administration has manipulated the scene concerning Saddam being a threat and weapons of mass destruction. And he scientifically and programmically broke down how this whole thing was being concocted from the earliest stages after 9/11. But see, rather them did not have people like Ritter on. You remember back in the time, what Ritter was doing was, I'll obey my president, you know, and came on these little night, you know, late night shows and stuff like that with a droopy face, pledging allegiance to whatever his commander in chief ordered him to do. So basically, from a journalistic standpoint, he was offering any kind of journalistic integrity to be slaughtered like a little lamb. You know, he just gave it to the wolves because basically he's beholden to that whole situation. There's been so many things within that whole spectrum of how they behaved and how they didn't question in any way what was starting to take place and what was in a strong question amongst not only people in this country, but the world community. You remember, they never got the full acceptance of the UN in their belief that Saddam was a threat, that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction, so on and so forth. So what were they doing? They were spying on people in nations that were had some dissent. They were going out and trying to ruin the careers of people who, you know, voiced opposition to some of their manufactured evidence and things of that particular nature. They constructed under the Powell plan, which basically was a design that Powell came up with after his critique of how the U.S. Empire lost the Vietnam War. And part of that critique was to control the media. So people like Judith Miller played a more prominent role in not only manufacturing evidence for the empire, but also being a mouthpiece and being an embedded reporter who was totally obliged to accept anything Massa said. All of this type of stuff should come within the spectrum of the critique if they're going to have a real discussion. But instead, they, you know, they pretend like they're flogging themselves a little bit, but then have you looking in another direction while they're carrying on the same old agenda. Yet at the same time, Rather and the others know that they're caught within this contradiction, as it will come out more and more. So next, let's go into, as the host, Orletta, goes into the big mistake and how big it was by Ravis and CBS. So let's see how they respond to this, and then we'll take it from there. Check this out.
In fairness to the CBS aired a program on September 8th, which they defended for a period of almost 10 days. And then Dan candidly faced his viewers and said, "We made a big mistake, and I'm sorry, and I'm personally sorry," he said. So CBS has acknowledged mistakes. So, I mean, you defend Dan, and obviously there's a tremendous amount of support for you in this room and your career, which is the context it was placed in. But CBS did make a big journalistic mistake.
The issue is not whether CBS made a mistake. We know that CBS made a mistake, and we know that there's an investigation underway. It's the motivation for that mistake. And it was a big mistake, in my judgment, by blowing it way out of proportion and assigning to it motivation that I don't think can be supported by the fact that this was a deliberate political attempt to unfairly criticize the president, because there were two issues here. One were the documents, and the other one was the issue that was raised by the documents about the president's conduct when he was a member of the National Guard.
Once again, what we have is a smoke and mirrors game, because this is just the right wing in Boy George's camp, as opposed to Kerry's camp at this time, because Boy George's camp is in the White House. Basically, they're screaming that, you know, there's biasness and so on and so forth by Rathers and CBS. But as I said, this is hocus pocus. Look, Seymour Hersh. Seymour Hersh is the noted journalist, and he's broken many stories, including May Lai, you know, during the Vietnam days. Well, fairly recently, he's broken the story of the Abu Ghraib. Now, he's related how he didn't originally have the story. Actually, Dan Rathers and CBS had the story. Those guys, various soldiers, came to Dan Rathers and CBS with the story, and the Pentagon, Boy George and them, called up Rathers and asked him to hold it up, not to come out with the information. And Rathers, being a good, obedient servant, did that. Even though he had hard documented evidence, non-forged, verifiable, etc., etc. But since it was going to be more than a little devastating to the overall image of the imperial class, they just did what the Pentagon said. So obviously, Rathers and CBS are not somehow antagonistic against Boy George's administration. This is a fallacy. Rathers has a legacy of this. If you look at some of the pictorial books by Grodin is a noted like JFK examiner and RFK examiner in photography and other things. And he has several books out which just deals with the photography of various assassinations, you know, so like the autopsy pictures of Kennedy and the various bullet holes in the limousine and so on and so forth. Well, one of the things he notes in his book, and shows it in one of his pictorial books, and has it in a documentary also, where he's in one of these, you know, like DVD documentaries on the Kennedy assassination. He goes into how CBS commissioned Rathers to go and look at the Zapruder film. Zapruder is the one who, Abraham Zapruder is the guy who filmed Kennedy getting his head shot off, and put in a bid to buy it. So Rathers, a young Rathers at the time, back in 1963, went and did that, offered Zapruder some money for it. Zapruder turned them down, but he viewed the assassination, which had not been seen and was not going to be seen for years and years to the American public overall. Rathers came back live on CBS TV and said, "I just saw the assassination of our president." And then he goes, and he was shot in the back of the head, and then, you know, his head thrust violently down. And in the video, you see Rathers going through the motion of his head being thrust downward. Now, whatever anyone's opinion is on the Kennedy assassination, no one tries to say that Kennedy's head was thrust downward. It's clear it was thrust to the back and to the left. He was thrust backwards, you know, and to the left. That he was not thrust forward. In other words, he wasn't struck in the back of the head and his body thrust forward in a forward motion, which Rathers not only tried to imply, it's what he outwardly said. Once again, this shows someone who has a deep allegiance to the ruling class within this society. He is not in some kind of opposition. This is like watching Crossfire when you got one right-wing Democrat and another right-wing Republican pretending that they're enemies, you know, mortal enemies, and on opposition and fierce opposition to one another, and they rant and rave back and forth over the most minute details to create this artificial heat that that they're actually in some kind of a conflict with one another. This is this make-believe. But next, let's go into Orletta as he asks about how the low confidence of the American public is playing itself out when they view the corporate media spectrum. So let's see how Rathers and others deal with this question. Check this out.
You know, one of the things, I mean, I take your point, Tom, about the outrageous comments that somehow CBS is comparable to Jason Blair, who was a liar, and no one has found or suggested any evidence that CBS lied in the mistake they made. But if you look at the Pew poll, it shows that only 38% of the American public believes that journalism, all of journalism, not just broadcast journalism, is not biased. How do we regain the public trust? How does journalism regain the public trust? Dan?
Well, frankly, I'm encouraged by that because I think people should be skeptical. Not cynical, but skeptical about the press. The fact that 38% of the people say, well, I'm not sure I trust the press, I see it as fairly healthy for the country that people are that skeptical. About the bias, I find that people, generally speaking, have that in good perspective, which is that if you don't report as somebody wants you to report, if you don't reflect the news through the prism of their prejudices, then they're going to call you biased. I think the public understands, by and large, that that's it. I think they also understand that journalism is not a science. On its best days, it's a kind of crude art, and therefore they bring skepticism to it. Now, there certainly is a section of the public that takes the view, if you don't report it the way I want you to report it, then I'm going to hang some uncomplimentary sign around you, and I'm going to try to make that stick. And in some ways, they succeed. But by and large, with the public as a whole, I don't think they do.
What has happened now, because of the tools that are available, both across the political spectrum from left to right, is that they can, in fact, enlist constituencies in a way that they haven't. I mean, Brent Wozell has, you know, an entire organization devoted to doing as much damage, and I choose that word carefully, as he can to the credibility of the news divisions. And now, on the left, there are the young bloggers out there who are anti-establishment and have their own kind of schematic for as is their right, to offer up this criticism and to develop constituencies around it. These three aging white men are stuck somewhere in the middle. They're, you know, trying to, on a nightly basis, give a fair and accurate picture of what's going on in the world in a contextual way, dealing with the facts as best we can.
I think there is, your question was, well, how can we increase the trust? I don't want to leave the question without saying it, it's worthy of us to try to increase the number of people who trust what we do, to put skepticism at rest when we can. And among the things we can do is not give up the fight, which is to say, not give up the fight, say, I'm an independent journalist. I don't have a political agenda. I understand that some people who are practicing journalism do. I can respect that. But what I'm trying to do is be an honest broker of information. I'm going to make my mistakes. We can't be perfect, but that's what I'm trying to do. And not give in to those who say, I'm biased and I'm giving out biased news and I don't mind that the world knows it. And for anybody who is not committed to that, then we're going to create such an environment for them that we either drive them out of the business or you get them to come over to our side. Now, I think that's a fight worth waging. Every administration in my lifetime has tried to do it. They've gotten better each time, just to take the presidency, the executive branch, the government, for example. They put together a machine, and each time it's gotten better, which basically, whether they acknowledge it or not, is we want to instill fear in you that you won't ask tough questions, you won't do aggressive, bold reporting, and if you do try it, stand by, because we will do our very best to smear you. Some people don't like the word smear. Discredit, if you like. And any time you're right, and it's something you don't like, we will attack you, the messenger, because we can't attack you on the facts when we can't. Again, I think the public recognizes that. You say, what can we do with the trust? I think is don't give up the fight. Once we say, listen, the pressure is so great, the price is so high to pay for independent trying to be an honest broker of information, once we give up that fight, then I think we give up something that's important not only to journalism, but also important to the country.
Peter,
once again, this is kind of sick, but it gets to some of the methodology of these hacks and how they are trapped within their own allegiance to the market corporate journalism spectrum. They want the notoriety as good sound journalists. Then at the same time, they try to make comments about how journalism is not a science and all of this type of stuff, as if you can't use somewhat of a scientific method. And obviously there's all types of things where you have to bring a scientific method into journalism, like the environment. How in the hell has journalism in this country, through the corporate media spectrum, has been so far behind on the issue of global warming and all of that? It's because of the spheres of influence of the ruling classes and the administration. It's because we have a society that is a petroleum-based society, and these large oil companies who often own or conglomeration over many of the networks do not want arguments out concerning alternative energy and what is happening to the biosphere around the planet because of the degradation of the petroleum-based society that we're using and that we're in, and how it's being abused and stuff. Now, Sam has jumped out of everything he could. You know, the Kyoto Protocol and all of this type of stuff. And rather than them, they were just reported as, well, the administration said they don't agree with some of the rules and limitations on the Kyoto Protocol and stuff like that, instead of addressing it scientifically about the dangers of it. They would let right-wing hacks spin out these little statistics about how since in one area of the world it wasn't 1 degree higher than it was the previous year, this proves that global warming isn't going on. as if that's some kind of indication. And they allowed this whole process of the U.S. Empire not engaging in the environmental issues of our time, which are some of the crucial issues, also concerning water. I mean, right down the line, recently we had a mad cow breakout. Now, it turns out that Japan tests all of its cows before it gets slaughtered. It turns out SAM tests about 1%. Now, from a scientific standpoint, there obviously needs to be a discussion, because basically you're just throwing, fleas in a haystack and hoping that a flea happens to land on a particular haystack that's in the middle of the haystack. And then saying, well, you know, if it does turn out that flea lands on that haystack, maybe we do have a problem with mad cow disease. In other words, it's designed not in a scientific method by the cow industries and all of them who are setting up these regulations, to actually come to any resolution or any kind of safety procedure for the masses of people. Now, in a sane society, the journalists that be would take it upon themselves to question and set up types of analysis that would bring science into it. This is in part what St. Clair, he's the legendary writer in early 1900s, who wrote about the meat industry, the meat packing industry back then, and exposed how basically medieval American society was on its whole meat packing trade. And that set off a wavelength of trade and change. But journalism has been so much more compromised that when Eric Schlosser, who's not in the corporate media, but he's a writer, he's written what many people consider the 21st century Upton St. Clair meat book, that being Fast Food Nation. And basically, it kind of just went out, I'm talking within the corporate media spectrum, without a peter. Even though all types of science was brought in to Eric Schlosser's analysis about what's going on in the fast food meat industry. So once again, these guys are just hypnotizers. They're hypnotists. And if you get caught up on their so-called status, they'll bamboozle you into thinking that a corn chip is a cantaloupe. After all, journalism isn't science. Next, Ornetta asked the anchor, is the anchor. Ornetta, who's the moderator, he asked the various anchors what they wish they had done differently before the Iraq war took place. So let's see how these guys handle this simple question. And we'll take it from there. Check this out.
What do you wish you could play back the reel and do over in terms of the coverage of lead up to the war in Iraq?
Not asking enough questions. We didn't ask enough questions. Let me just speak for myself. Didn't ask enough questions. Didn't follow up the questions we did ask. Follow enough, strong enough, long enough, hard enough to have one of two things happen. Either get the questions answered or to clearly demonstrate that they weren't going to answer the questions, which would then raise the other. Whereas the roll-up to war that we had, this is where fear begins to eat into even the best of us. Again, let me speak for myself. What I described earlier, either the flag is waving, the Sousa music is playing, and again, just speaking to myself, if the country is in dire peril, as the President of the United States says it is, and I don't think we differ on this, but if we do, the figure himself, if, I care about this country deeply, I want to be patriotic, I think I am patriotic, I want to be a patriotic journalist, here's what happens inside a journalist's mind, at least this one. You begin to get confused as to what the role of the patriotic journalist is. You know that the role of the patriotic journalist is to put your fear aside, stand up, look them in the eye, ask the right question. But you also know that when you do that, you're going to get hammered, and you might get hammered into dog meat. So what happens is you just say, you know, yeah, we ought to ask that question, but maybe tomorrow. And then maybe tomorrow, and maybe tomorrow, and the next thing you know, the war's there. And answer your question, that the one thing that I think I wish I had done better is ask more questions, had more courage to ask more of the tougher questions, and to not confuse my role as a patriotic journalist with the role of trying to protect your popularity, your ratings, your demographics, and all of that stuff that doesn't really matter in the big picture of what's best for the country.
Basically, he's an obedient, broken-down old man. And he's pretending to be a journalist under the guise of being patriotic. You know, another little scoundrel hiding under the banner of patriotism. He just happens to be a journalist, you know. So you have a situation where here, this guy's been around forever. He knows what sound journalism is, or is supposed to be. He knows that if someone is reporting to the public facts that aren't verifiable, lies straight out, things where they're twisting the evidence to a whole new level, that the job of a good sound journalist is to question those regardless of you know, who's saying it or why they're saying it. But see, he's part of the whole system. He says that he becomes confused on what to do. How in the hell could someone who has been around this long been confused? He's not confused. He's compliant with the system. And the only thing that he may have a little reservation about is basically, is there any level of questioning those in power that is acceptable today? That, I mean, that's basically what some of these guys are trying to figure out. Basically, we have a ruling class that's sitting on top of a mountain like Thor, and any attempt by those who are supposed to be in alignment with them, and are in alignment with them, the corporate media, they know that they are going to get the rage of the administration and the ruling class. So basically, he's pretending like he's confused on how much of and how much vigilance he should come out with, when in actuality, it's a situation where he knows that even if he pretends that he's trying to be objective, that nowadays that may catch the wrath of the administration. And they don't do anything to try to offset it. And the proof of that is the whole Valerie Plame situation. Here you have, which is fine that, you know, they're basically committing fratricization amongst themselves. But my whole point is that Valerie Plame was a CIA operative undercover who, you know, looks into things concerning operatives in cases like uranium. And when the U.S., her husband, who was an ambassador to Iraq at one time, came out and said that the Niger story, where Saddam was trying to buy uranium from Niger, couldn't be verified. Basically, what the Pentagon did was leak out the name of Valerie Plame, the ambassador's wife, to Robert Novak, one of the CNN crossfire hacks. And he released it to the public, thereby ruining her career. That's what many of these guys, including Rathers, are really motivated by. It's their career, you know. And they hit them, Plane in them, where it hurts, their career. So they Plane loses her career, and that was a message. Now, what Rathers and them should have done, I'm talking about in a civilized, you know, if they, even if they were civilized bourgeois, you know, media hacks, they would have denounced their partner, Robert Novak, for what he did because of the loss of integrity. But they're so compliant that they didn't even really do much about that. And they just looked at it as a so-called objective story. The administration says that no one has, that they know of, has released the name to Robert Novak. So all sides are looking into this more later. You know, all that type of junk. When it's clear that it came from the Pentagon, these guys are just playing games and stuff. So instead of addressing these issues and how they fester and how rotten the system is, you know, because Rathers admitted it in a sense when he said that if you do come out too quote unquote aggressive, you get hammered. That basically means that the system is rotten. That, you know, whenever you have a society where you can't even stick your head up to question some of the policies of those who are supposed to, quote unquote, be there in your interest, then that exposes the whole system right there. So Rathers is basically, and Brokaw and Jennings, they're trapped. They sold their souls a long time ago, and now they're trapped in a system and in an empire that is carrying out in the most brutal and naked ways. And they find themselves looking bad also because of how ruthless the whole empire itself is looking through the eyes of the majority of the people in the world. Now next, Ornetta asks Jennings about the good and bad journalism that has been taking place during this presidential campaign. So let's see how Jennings responds to this. Check this out.
Peter, when you, we've still got a month to go, but looking back over this very long campaign, what do you think are the, what's the outstanding mistake and what is the outstanding good journalism that's been done in this campaign?
Well, I'd be a little provocative here. I think I'm a little provocative anyway, just because I wouldn't call it a mistake necessarily. But one of the turning points for me, it seems to me, was when I talked a little bit about the press wanting a narrative. On the night of the Iowa caucuses, when Howard Dean let out what was alleged to be the scream heard around the world, I thought the press was very quick to decide that Dean was a bad-tempered guy. Many people had thought so, and a slightly wavering character emotionally. And that the press, in a very large way, took that as an incident and ran with it. One of the most important small pieces of journalism I think we did the next day, it was really more of a technical analysis than it really was journalism. Diane Sawyer took the kind of microphone that Dean was using at the post-event celebration and explained that it's the same kind of microphone that they use when they're out on the street in the morning talking to the audiences in New York City, and we explained how it used and how Howard Dean never sounded to the audience in that room in any way, shape, or form as he sounded on the television. But nobody, it seemed to me, at the press, I think, had sort of, you wanted a new story, but what a comeback story, you see, for John Kerry. And so I thought that the relentless hammering of Dean at that point was something of a turning point. And I've never spoken to him about it, but I'm pretty sure he thinks the same thing.
He said the same thing. Dan, what stands out, both good and bad, in the press coverage of the campaign?
Well, on the bad side, we still report too much of the process and not enough of the substance. That includes far too much reliance on polls.
that what we haven't done, and again, let me just speak for myself, when I look back and say, well, what did I dedicate myself to doing this year that I haven't followed up on, haven't done well enough and have done? Follow the dollar. It's journalism 101, covering politics. You want to know what's going on, follow the money. We haven't done that very well. We were looking at a presidential campaign which, top to bottom, all things considered, may be a $2 billion presidential campaign. A lot of people are giving a lot of huge money and concentrating on who are these people who are giving this money. What do they expect to get for this kind of money? Never ruling out the possibility of altruism, that some people don't give money for the best of reasons, but an awful lot of people don't. If we haven't followed the dollar, if we haven't concentrated on the substance as opposed to the process, too much reliance on polls. And in the end, I would prefer to use a great deal of the money we use for polling to increase our coverage of where do the candidates stand on certain positions and what the difference of the positions are. It's not to say that polling is not, useless, and I think, Peter, both you and Tom have said, we're at our worst when we use it. Just here's the latest poll, and nationally carry is up by...
But you can do this, Dan. You can take money. I mean, you have the authority to take money out of the polling unit and put it to issue reporting. If you, and I mean you, your news division, want to, why do you think you don't?
Good question. I think they don't because they think I'm full of prunes when I suggest doing it. And they run it. I think that, one, there are differing views. Honest people can... Sorry?
Full of prunes?
Yes. But this is a New Yorker audience. You know?
Once again, we have this kind of a minstrel performance going on. You know, a lot of this stuff, you know, a lot of this is a manipulation of the masses, even when they talk about polls, because we have an electoral college system in this wretched society. It's not even one person, one vote. So if you are a Republican, let's say in California, your vote basically is for nil concerning the presidential election, because it's not like your vote is going to count to the overall masses. So when they do these polls and say, you know, 54% of the people are going for Boy George as opposed to, 49 who are going for Knucklehead Carey, it really doesn't mean anything because it's an electoral system. So the overall percentage of people going, look, Gore, I had a higher percentage of votes during the actual election in 2000 than Boy George, even if you don't count the ones that were excluded in Florida. He still had more votes, so he had a higher percentage. But he still lost because Boy George had more electoral votes. So when they do this, this is just a simplified way to get you to go into this kind of mass thought without any kind of critical examination about, amongst other things, what this voting process even really means. Also, you know, Rathers went into this stuff about we should ask more questions about, you know, these people who are involved in these policies and within these administrations. What do they expect for the money that they're throwing around? Look, it's clear that in a capitalist system, that if a corporation is giving Boy George or Carey some money for his campaign, of course they expect something. And there's a long track record that they could easily follow up on to prove the paybacks that they've gotten. They could do it with Boy George currently. They could do it with Crime Bill Clinton in the past and on down the line. They don't do it because they're a part of it. The corporations that they work for are the ones who are playing a part in these policies. So it's just a con game that's going on, where here you got these two guys who are these three guys who are saying things that know is on some of the minds of many people. They know that many people are stewing about a lot of the problems that they see within the governmental system in this wretched society, and also within the whole corporate media system. So they say things about that expresses some kind of false concern. Meanwhile, they don't address and have never really addressed some fundamental questions that, you have a situation where today 71% of the U.S. corporations pay no taxes at all. Yet John Kerry, Kerry's principal economic advisor, is basically Wall Street's Warren Buffett, who along with George Shultz, who plays the same role for Arnold Schwarzenegger, helped set those policies for the corporations to get away with all of this looting and avoidance of paying taxes. You have a situation where Kerry asked McCain, who's a Republican, to be on his ticket. In other words, to be his vice president. Now, in a sound journalistic society, especially for those who are always spouting off lesser of two evil concept, one would think that that says something if it's so easy for people who call themselves Republicans or Democrats to basically just switch sides, like, you know, it's like they're jumping sides of to a checkerboard or something. You know, one minute they're on this side of the checkerboard, then they, a few steps later they're on the next side. But see, Rathers and them are not concerned with bringing any of these things to question, because they don't want to challenge any way the status quo. So they just keep the whole brain drain dumpified process going on. Now next, Brokaw talks about wanting to see more debates with Boy George and Kerry. Let's see what he means by debates. Check this out.
I think that there ought to be much more of a drive in this country and a passion for having more debates, not fewer debates. And that the networks... we're effectively cut out of the process. We gave 90 minutes the other night to the debate, as ABC and CBS did, and it was a video war on America. And it was a great thing because there was something real that was happening. We saw these two candidates debating each other and arguing over the great issues of the day. But under the rules that have now kind of grown up out of the political landscape, if ABC or CBS or NBC went to the candidates and said, look, we'd like to give you 4 hours of prime time for a debate, they'd say, we can't do that. The commission has agreed that it will run the debates, and the two campaigns, the commission, which is a commission which is pretty much owned and operated by the two parties. Campaigns,
right,
by the parties.
It used to be the League of Women Voters.
That's
did
right.
It. What happened
they
to
took
that?
It away from them. But what happened to it is that Newt Minow created this commission, and there are a lot of good people that are in this commission, but it has kind of developed what I described as extra-legal status in America. It has no statutory standing or constitutional standing. The two chairs of the commission, one is Paul Kirk, who is a former Democratic National Chairman, and the other one is Frank Fahrenkopf, former Republican Party Chairman, now chief lobbyist for the Las Vegas gaming industry. And the rules and the determination about who shall participate and the nature of the debate is all worked out within those parties. And there's very little public discussion about that, or, with all due respect, media criticism
of that. In many respects, we were lucky to get as good a debate, I think, as we did the other night.
Yeah. We had a very good
debate.
Given
the 32 pages of agreement, which we finally, as you know, as networks, just simply wouldn't sign on to. Had we signed on to those agreements, you would have never seen the cutaways of George Bush.
Ken, there's a hippopotamus in the room here, which is... we did not see a debate the other night. We saw a carefully scripted, carefully confined joint appearance. It was valuable, but we've all found, including myself, you fall into the habit of, the politicians want this described as a debate. They work very hard to have it described as a debate, and it goes into the language of debate. We didn't have a debate the other night. The candidates cannot talk to one another. So we need to understand that.
So when you say a debate, when you say the candidates need to talk to each other, you would have it, your ideal debate would be a kind of a free form where they, you wouldn't have that ground rule. They could talk to each other and you could ask unlimited follow-up questions. Is that what you're saying?
Take the rules, whatever high school you go to or went to, take the high school rules for debate and apply those rules to and make it a debate. There is a dictionary definition of debate. What we saw the other night does not meet the dictionary definition of debate. It certainly does not meet the definition of debate that your average high school or college has. Just take those rules and apply them. And a certain amount of civility is built into those rules, but a certain amount of directly challenging the other candidate. This is what the politicians, in their word from the past, their backroom ways of taking over this commission. The commission is run by the party campaigns themselves, and it's constructed to give them the maximum advantage and their candidates, each candidate, the maximum protection. Why are we allowing the politicians themselves to set the rules for these debates?
That's a very good point.
If they refuse to have a real debate, then we at least have drawn the issue. And I know you agree with that, so when I say...
And you say it wasn't a real debate, but the networks devoted an hour and a half to it.
Yes, and I think rightly so.
Even though it wasn't a real debate.
I would prefer debates, but I think it was of value to the audience. I don't argue that it was without value. I think it would be more value if we had real debates.
First of all, they had real debates, it would be a much broader spectrum of people who actually believe in this little silly system to get involved. So you would have people like Nader and so on and so forth. But it was that whole commission that, you know, when Nader was projected to have 5% of the vote during the 2000 election, which would allow him to get into the debates. The commission got together and raised it from 5% to 15%, effectively pushing Nader out. You didn't hear any outcry whatsoever by the corporate media, Rathers, Brokaw, you know, Jennings, about this undemocratic process. Now, this is someone, Nader, who believes in their system, but he would add more traditional vitality to the debate mechanism and expand the parameters of the debate they're in part complaining about now. So for Rathers to get up here and kind of, you know, bemoan the fact that it's not a real debate, which is not, is in a sense kind of a smoke and mirrors game. They help give legitimacy to the system. They help promote the system because they are the system. They're part of the corporate media spectrum. They're part of the network that wants their candidates protected as much as possible so that they can give the illusion that they are there for legit reasons. Thereby, when they go and loot and rape and pillage someone else's country at your expense, they'll be giving not only the green light by the corporate media spectrum that Rathers and them are a part of, but be given a wink and a nod of approval. So this is just a hocus-pocus game once again. When they, you know, go on and on about... what they would like to see and so on and so forth. If Rathers and company were really working in a system that had the type of vitality and openness that they are pretending, and this is my whole point, that it does, then they would be able to help implement these things in. But as Rather himself knows and has mentioned it before, he would catch the wrath of the empire. So he's trapped. He wants it both ways. He wants to pretend that he's out there as a proponent for the masses of the people, when basically he's just a patriotic slave to the corporate ruling system that he has played a role diligently in for years.
Yeah, I just want to add on to that, too, just to expand a little bit about the corporate power. You know, I mean, these debates, so-called debates, the sham that they put together of a debate, you know, was regulated in a way that, I mean, the audience was sequestered. They weren't allowed to ask any questions or anything like that. So you couldn't get a third party perspective or, you know, a hard left perspective interjection. The questions were, controlled by the moderator. Like they mentioned about the League of Women Voters, once running it, you know, but now the corporations run it. Now, while the people, the audience was sequestered, I think it's important to note that the some of the corporations had free license, you know, to set up their little, you know, advertisements and stuff like that. You know, you had cigarette companies, you know, beer, you know, all those people. Those are Dan Rather's. Those are Ted Koppel's corporate masters. That's part of what the wrath, you know, comes down to. So the corporations have a voice. They can do what they want. They can say what they want. They can act how they want. They can talk when they want. The whole shot. But the people ain't got no voice. And if these knuckleheads, these fig leaves, who are or these corporate mouthpieces for the ruling class, you know, speak on, try and present, make a presentation on our behalf, then corporate daddy comes down on the hard.
And that's a process that teaches discipline for those who want to participate in that system. So if you want to be a broken down slave, you know, I mean, that's just your world, rather, but that's something that you chose. Recently, as we finish this up right quick, a student. And this shows you how the mechanisms of corporate financial industry takes place at people as soon as they start hitting the school system. They had a employment at McDonald's Day at this guy's high school. Basically, they got all these students together, put them in the gym and had them go through a mock interview to get a job at McDonald's. So this one student comes up there. They ask him, so why do you want to work for McDonald's? He goes, I don't. And they go, what do you mean you don't? And they go, well, first of all, you guys put out processed type of meat that has been highly contaminated and so on and so forth, and just broke down some of the stuff that he had seen or read from Eric Schloss's book. Next thing he knew, boom, suspended. So here's the whole mechanism basically saying, look, you want to be like, if you want to be like Rathis and possibly have a job in the industry as a a media corporate hack, you can't be talking any kind of sound scientific and, you know, analytical thoughts. You know, you got to, you know, get in line. Another student, they had, you know how these schools are being bought up by all these various corporations, and if Pepsi or Coke come into your school, they want everything Coke. If they give you like a stadium light for your football field, they want all of the machines Coca-Cola, and they don't want Pepsi. So then at one school they had it that way. And they were going to have a Coke Day where everyone was going to stand around and smile, you know, as the people and representatives from Coca-Cola took pictures. And one smart aleck student had a Pepsi shirt on. Boom! Suspended. You know, once again, the disciplining mechanism is ready to take place. And fortunately, they're not broken down slaves. Like Rathis, they just took the punch and just kept swinging back. Rathis, he doesn't take the punch anymore. He doesn't swing, or he takes the punch, he just drops to his knees and starts mumbling to himself. In this kind of, you know, degraded, demoralized chant. out to the public, but he doesn't get up on his feet and start swinging back like a real human.
Yeah. That's real, man. And on a related note, you know, Coca-Cola, you know, they came to prominence, you know, through a man named Asa Candler. Asa Candler, you know, was a founder of Coca-Cola, was some kind of pharmacist, you know, snake oil salesman or whatever, you know what I'm saying? And looking for a way to remedy the bump on his head he had years ago. But he owned slaves. Looked like Coca-Cola still owns slaves.
They still do. Rathers, Jennings, Brokaw, just to name a few. And anyone else who plays the game within the corporate media system. Hold on a sec. Well, that's just going to about wrap it up for tonight. It's about that time that we realize that instead of pouring corporate garbage not only into our mouths to drown us out, but into our eyes to blind us, we need to look through it with x-ray vision and from time to time take a little sip of lilac wine. Until the next time, slave revolt. Out.